sidebands. Nothing worse than, especially with split repeaters these days, to have your Morse code keying up machines two sides of either side of you every time it comes up to ID. So we built a 16-step approximation of a sine wave with an envelope generator on it so that the Morse code could be generated that way, and in fact we can change the frequency of it by program software. And the algorithm, which Tom will explain, that was used in that thing is pretty simple, using essentially one byte per character. And it's a pretty slick system. We have adjustable character lengths, and we put messages in there, and believe it or not, the people on this repeater, who a lot of them got their license without knowing the code, are starting to learn code because they want to find out what dirty message is stored in there every 5 minutes. So it's been an advance in doing that. At least somebody's learning something. We also put in some other features. We put in in software touch tone pad testing, which allows the user to, when he puts a new touch tone pad on his transceiver, to have the computer test his touch tone pad to see if it's working, to see if the level is high enough, to see if it's getting the proper digits. We have in the works now, with the addition of 8K of memory to the system, deviation set, which will allow a user to set his deviation by himself without having an additional station on board. Frequency set, which will allow him to set his frequency to the repeater's received frequency without having an additional station on board. And auto patch with controls of who's making the calls, whether or not the proper identification code has been put in, how many message units the guys use, that sort of thing. We obviously toll protection, so we don't want to call Japan to have a cross-link with a Japanese non-repeater over there, and other things like that. We also, from the control system, we went ahead and did a complete revamp of the rest of the repeater. The receivers were kept because they were good quality. We ended up using General Electric Master Pro type receivers. We built our own transmitters around a General Electric Master II exciter and our own strip line amplifiers, both for UHF and VHF, and built interfaces so that the transmitter, so that all the equipment can be controlled by the processor. Now, something very interesting. In this repeater, there is no COR. There is no carrier-operated relay generator. There's nothing. It's all generated in software. The repeater is under real-time control at all times, and in fact, all of the maintenance and supervision and management of the operation of the system is done by the computer all the time. So we've actually got a block which consists of a transmitter, two transmitters, UHF-VHF, two receivers, UHF-VHF, phone line for computer interface and for auto patch, and then this box in the middle called the processor. And the receivers go into it, and the processor feeds the transmitters, COR audio. From the standpoint of audio, we have an audio matrix system, which in our system is 8 audio inputs and 8 audio outputs, all controlled by the processor system. And the processor selects which of the cross connections on the 8x8 matrix has to be made, so therefore we can actually do any of the interlinks, interties, or controls of anything that we want to do. Some interesting reasons for doing that were purely from some of the problems that happened to WR6ABM. For instance, the infamous jammer that decided one night on UHF that he would take a 555 timer and attach it to the COR lead on his transceiver and set it so that it was just a little bit longer than the squelch tail time of the repeater, so that all night long you would hear the repeater going he was really getting his jollies from that. Well, the first thing we did was to dial through the touch tone pad, tell the processor to make the squelch tail length longer. Well, we did that, and after 3.5 minutes, the repeater timed out. So then he dropped it and brought it back up and kept on doing that. Well, finally, everybody got fed up with that, and this was on UHF, so we called the computer up via the teletype and told it to swap the primary UHF receiver with the regular UHF receiver. And what that did was then make a repeater out of our primary channel and our conventional transmitter. And then we brought up about 5 or 6 of the primary stations and got on and started having a conversation. And while we were doing that, Tom was busy looking at the teletype watching this poor man frustrated as hell because he's not able to jam anybody, and the COR lead is going like this on the receiver that is now disconnected. Well, with all of these capabilities, we've been able to make a repeater that will do just about anything we want to do by simply changing software. And what does that mean? Well, that means that there's no more of those midnight trips to the hill to change something. We don't ever have to go up to the hill anymore to change command codes. We can do those remotely. And we have been able to put together a system that can be used by really non-technical people. And yet it proves that the processor itself was able to handle an environment as sophisticated as this. As far as the software systems that were involved in how the overall repeater works, I'm going to let Tom give you a rundown on some of the algorithms and systems that he employed to do it. He's done some pretty interesting and sneaky things, considering that the overall system has run in less than 4K of memory, and we're going to be upping it to 8K to add features now, but the overall control and operational system ran in a very small amount of memory that went along with the processor. So with this, I'll let Tom get up and give you a quick rundown on that, and we'll take some questions from people after that.
Well, unlike previous speakers, I don't have any slides to show you. Flowcharts, never wrote them anyway. But it started out 2 years ago. 2 years ago this May, when we thought of this great idea of using a 6800, and we got together and we were going to lash up something. And Lou does a little bit of the hardware, and we wire up the mini bug that Motorola had, and we decided that we weren't too happy with that, as Lou said. So we spent about 2 months developing with an assembler the current debug IC, which has all the features of MicBug. And alleviates all of its screw-ups in the way of stack sizes, using a whole PIA just to control a silly teletype, speed changes and the like, and it requires a lot less components. So we went ahead and developed this. Well, when you start developing software like that, the first thing you want to realize is how do you assemble it? Well, an assembler is one of those tricky things that you wish you could make overnight or get from somebody overnight and have it run on your system, whatever it is. So we decided that the cost of an assembler, if you go out and buy it from Motorola, which was the only people that were handling it at the time, $2,000? $2,000. Well, that's more than $300 for the processor, which we thought was exorbitant anyway. And decided, well, that's not really what we wanted. And I had at my disposal at the time, and still do, thank goodness, other people are still using it, a Xerox Sigma 5. It's when Xerox was still making them. And a very powerful macro assembler. So I went ahead and, in the flurry of what I think was about a week, generated enough macro definitions, complete with errors at the time, to make an assembler run. A little bit different syntax than what Motorola specified, but completely readable nonetheless. So I went through the generation of that, and that's now in revision 7. Shows you what I've been changing in the blasted thing. Adding features here and there, making sure that relative jumps are really within range and the like, and hopefully solving the bug. So I got the assembler running and generating the S1 object tapes that you get out of the thing. And with that, we went ahead and Lou builds a little bit of the hardware, and I do a little bit of the software, and we make it test and make it run. So we went through that iteration. And about January last year, we decided this whole thing was going to really go up on the hill sometime soon. And got together all the hardware. Lou had just finished getting all the receivers together, getting the transmitters to work, get an audio matrix to work, get the memory to work at the right voltage. So we shuffled the cards together and came out with a full deck, amazingly enough. And all this while, we developed bits and pieces of hardware that we can demonstrate and show people. And I think it was about, a year ago, we had our, it was the June meeting of 75. We demonstrated a system that could turn on and off transmitters. Very rudimentary, but it did work. And I still don't understand quite how it worked at the time. We'd send Morse code via touch tone generator, which isn't the way we do it now, but it happened to be a convenient tone generator at the time, and we later built the synthesized modules. So we went ahead with all of this. And then I decided that this whole thing was gonna work in a real-time environment. So to call yourself real-time, you need a clock somewhere. So we designed a clock that, since we had 1 megacycle floating around, we divided it by an appropriate number to generate 50 cycles. And most of the clock chips that you get will run on 50 or 60 cycles. We wired it up for 50 cycles and got it so we could read out the time of day. And every 50th of a second, it generates a computer-generated interrupt. And that's one of the major interrupts in the system that's the basis for all the timing that we have. We get other interrupts from receiver carrier closures, CORs, if you will, that every time we get a transition, we build up some special hardware that detects transitions for state of the receiver. As soon as we get a transition detected, we decide, well, we really got to do something. And another one of the interrupts is there's an interrupt from the touch tone generator receiver when it's not falsing. That's another story entirely. And we hooked the whole thing up. And what I evolved out of this whole thing was a time-cued real-time event system where basically all the software is done in a foreground type environment where it's responding only to interrupts. And in the background, it's sitting there with the debug integrated circuit, so you can poke around and look at what's happening while everything's running around over your head at these 20 millisecond or 50 cycle time ticks. And a good for instance on this is Morse code generation. You want to figure out that you actually want to do generate Morse code. And I came in the middle of the previous speaker's talk, so I don't know how he did it on the generation side. But on ours, it's 1 byte per character. And I think that the coding method was described in an issue of QST back in the mid-60s, I think. Someone generated a Morse to Baudot decoder. And it involves basically shifting bits out and detecting a trailer bit. Kind of similar to the start-stop code for a teletype, but you have varying lengths, so you have to detect an end state. And it works, but you have to figure out that an A is not an ASCII equivalent. You got to stick in the special ones and zeros to make it come out DDA, and it magically does it. So we sit there and code up all the Morse stuff. So in the timing elements, when you're generating Morse code, you have your dot time interval and your dash time interval, and if you're doing Morse code correctly, the ratio is 3:1. Pardon me. And you turn on the audio oscillator, and then you go to a time NQ routine that says, wake me up after 3 time ticks. And you go away, and magically 3 time ticks later, it comes back and starts the process over again, and you can continue in a loop. And this wake-up thing is a little routine that's got like about 11 alarm clocks on the side, and it's setting them individually, and routines will tell it to turn it on, and one alarm clock you can say is your 3-minute timer. It says at the end of 3 minutes, wake me up, I got to turn off the transmitter. Another one of the alarm clocks will be, wake me up at the end of 2 minutes, because I'm going to give the guy a warning beep that he's talked too long. That happens quite frequently, it turns out. Another one of the alarm clocks is for the squelch tail generation, or hang time, so that the repeater carrier stays on for a longer period of time. And you have a little alarm clock when the receiver goes away, its carrier drops. You want to leave the transmitter on for a little longer, so you go and set an alarm clock that says, turn on, wake me up in so many seconds, and I'll turn off the transmitter. And that's the basic synthesis of it. It involves the generation of this alarm clock type routine. And then in the background, you can sit and poke around with a debugging routine. And if I had something around here that I could call it up, I could find out that in the past day there have been so many people punching the button, or so many carrier closures, or the transmitter's been keyed so many times, or I can find out what time of day it is because it's continually reading the clock and updating it. And various other goodies that we can put in. The whole thing seems to work nicely. We demo it, but the problem is that there's so much concrete around here, you can't get from here to the repeater through it all. We did try. But other than that, we could show you that we could change Morse code speeds and test touch tone pads, tell you the time of day, if people can read that, the time of day that fast, and the like. And that basically ends my waving of my hands, and I'll answer questions if people are interested. No questions?
What are you doing about the inner mic?
That's his problem. It's hard for it. Hardware. Yes.
Sounds like you're using an awful lot of controls. How many port control ports are you using?
What do you mean control ports?
PIAs.
PIAs?
I think we have 7 PIAs.
No,
on
we
only
have 3.
3?
Yeah, we have 3 PIAs.
Yeah.
One is used for transmitter keying. Another one is used for transmitter keying and receiver transition detectors. Another one is used for controlling the audio matrix, controlling the audio matrix power levels. It's got a DVM hooked to it. And the other one is used for the time of day encoder, and the touch tone encoder and decoder.
So we essentially have this point in time, the peripheral interface from the computer to the outside world is on 48 lines. But those then, some of them are multiplexed. We have, for instance, on the DVM, which is slated for telemetry as soon as we add more memory, the DVM has a multiplexer which selects up to 32 points in the system to make measurements of power output discriminator. It'll be, the DVM will be used during frequency set and deviation set, for instance. You'll be able to make the measurements on how far off the incoming station is on the discriminator zero, how much signal strength there is coming into the receiver. Once we have more memory, we can put things in like variable hysteresis squelch by measuring the second limiter current. We can determine whether or not the squelch has to be tight or loose, because we now have, we also have squelch control up there. So if the signals are very strong, the squelch could be made very tight, so there is no at the end of the at the end of the drop. But if the signal is very weak, then it will loosen the squelch up for that period of time, and that can be done all with processor. The only thing that's been holding us back has been the fact that we've run out of memory, and that's why we're adding more memory to the system, but there's plenty of I/O capability. One of the interesting things, is that in a week, WR6ADM's VHF has approximately 80,000 key-ups on their receiver.
Yeah, that includes a little bit of flutter,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it includes flutter, of course, but there's quite a number there. The VHF, the UHF, on the other hand, is running only about 4,000. It's an interesting differential between the users on V and the users on U. Yes?
I believe you're using a telenetics decoder. What are some of the problems you're having?
Signal noise ratio is there. The dynamic range is 15 dB.
Yeah, it has no dynamic range. It's very sensitive to falsing. It's lousy under a noise environment. With signal to noise ratio, if your signal to noise ratio is worse than about 35 dB, it will not decode. And it's terribly sensitive to voice falsing.
I thought the spec had about a 30 dB.
That's what they say, but it's been measured by myself and it's been measured by Lance Jenner of WR6ABH, and 15 dB is the best on all the parts we've had.
What kind of imbalance between high group and low group?
What tilt? I don't know what the tilt
there is. It's pretty good. There it's not bad. We have found maybe a 12 dB level in the high group.
It'll accept it. And most users' problems are in that field.
Yeah. There's a new part coming out by General Instrument, which is a monolithic version, which looks very good, and from my understanding has much better specs than the telematics part, and is only $25 instead of $150. So we are slated to go ahead and use that. And Motorola's got a CMOS version coming out towards the end of this year, which we're also going to look at.
The
Collins thing takes too much peripheral. It's only the decoder. You've got to add AGC limiting, a high group and low group filters, a bandpass filter in front of the whole thing. It's too difficult and also very expensive. It's $80. So.
The General Instrument one, if I remember correctly, has the components for the active filter, but you got to put the R's and C's around
it.
And it's very, very easy. They give you the component values.
$25. It's monolithic. And they have in two versions, one that's a 16, an output of one is 16, and the other one that's an output binary with a valid keystroke. And you can adjust things like the access time of the tone and that sort of thing. The telenetics part we were very excited with, and we started out with them when they were Tone Technology. We got their first decoder is back up on the hill, which doesn't have all of the features that their latest one has, because the first one works better than the latest one. The first ones, which were hand-built prototypes, have an AGC range of about 25, or a dynamic range of about 25 dB, but they don't have, quote-unquote, the voice false sensing stuff inside of them. But the new ones, which have that, just do not seem to be adequate for radio work at all. They seem to be very poor. In a telephone environment, you can probably tolerate, because the phone company generally sets the telephones up to be at a reasonably good level. I don't think telephones are much more than 6 dB off in level. But in a radio environment, you're going to find especially with people like the operators in repeaters that are very popular with operators that are not technically inclined, the levels can go all over the place. The guy who gets into his rice box with a tuning tool and says, okay, am I loud enough? Can I turn myself up? Is it loud enough now? Am I 5 kilohertz now? You know, meanwhile, he's splattering 30 kilohertz on either side of the repeater. So that was probably one of the most difficult things. But we felt that we wanted to go with a system decoder rather than build one or use a telephone company 247 or 347B. Yes?
Can you
I'm sorry.
Can you describe your CLR similar to the lack of CLR?
Yeah, the receiver comes in, the receiver COR comes in, first of all, in the GE receiver, there's a thing called COSP, which is a level that goes from 0 to 2 volts. But we felt that the problem we were going to have here is if we fixed ourselves into having a TTL input, we're going to have problems if the group ever wanted to swap receivers for, say, a Master 2 receiver, which is a new one. So we put in on our, what we call the COR PIA board, we have inputs that are programmable for the transition level. We can set the actual input level at which the input will have a transition. Then from those input buffers, it goes to a transition detector, which amounts to a D register on each one of the inputs, and an exclusive OR that looks at the input versus the output of the D register. And what happens is that it loads the D register, and then sees a transition because the D register input and output are the same for a period of time, and then all of a sudden the output isn't the same. And that transition is then fed to the interrupt line on the PIA. At the same time, the output of the D register, which has now been latched, holds the data necessary for the software to go back and find out who was the one who keyed up so that it can go ahead and do the necessary stuff that has to be happening inside the processor. And this is updated, the D register is updated at the interrupt rate, which is the clock cycle, the 50 hertz clock cycle, updates the interrupts all the time.
Maybe what I missed is, where does this COSP level come from?
It comes from the receiver. It comes from the receiver.
Is it like rectified noise or something?
Yeah, the receiver itself has a standard squelch circuit, and we've just taken the output of the standard receiver squelch circuit and fed it in. But there's no COR per se. We don't have a COR detector to let the microprocessor.
One of the things that's kind of interesting about the whole system is you go up to most other repeater sites, and when people are transmitting or talking to the machine, you hear relays click and all sorts of things. Well, the only thing you hear on this is this god-awful sound of 11 zillion blowers. It sounds like a 747 at close range. And it turns out
1100 CFM of fans.
Big, huge fans. Power supply to match, mostly for the transmitters. And the way we have the power wired up, it's through a battery backup system. And it turns out that one of the easiest ways to service is go over and flip the breaker, which puts it on battery power and turns off all the fans so you can hear yourself think. And then it becomes very quiet. And you can talk all you want, and people come around and you don't hear anything because there's not a blasted relay in the whole thing.
The only other noise it makes is the minus 12 inverter, which is there for the ROM and the EIA drivers for the teletype. One of the things that we did, the system was built from the ground up. We built a power supply for it, which was, the power supply probably was the longest hardware item to build in the whole group. And the reason why was that, number one, it had to be reliable. I say that with a smile looking at a certain person in the room. That's a long private story. And it had a lot of outputs and things that had to be done. The primary thing about it was that the first portion of it is 120 amp fully regulated battery charger with low current ripple. And it has pretty close to about a half a farad worth of capacitance in the initial filtering before the first set of regulators. And the regulators are essentially 300 amperes with a regulator of transistors being used at 150 amps with short circuit protection, which has been tested, and it's shut down short circuit protection. It's not current limiting, because current limiting tends to burn up the wrench that you put across the thing to test it. So we decided that we'd shut the power supply down, and it shuts down about 50 milliseconds after a short has been applied, or actually anything that draws more than about 120 amps will shut it down. From this, the bus is 17 volts. Our main power distribution in the repeater is a 17 volt system. And people say, well, how come it's 17 volts? The receivers run at 12 and the transmitters run at 12. Why did you choose 17? Well, we chose 17 for one very important reason, and that was that no one in the semiconductor industry these days yet makes a good, reliable PNP transistor, power transistor. Most of them are epitaxial or double diffuse type transistors where their thermal capabilities are nowhere near as good. Their resistance to hot spotting and thermal cycling is poor. And so even though PNPs are nice because in a power supply situation you only have a saturation voltage to make up for, single diffused NPNs are a lot nicer because they will take a lot more abuse. So in the power supply, we have a triple Darlington drive in which the output transistor actually is made up of six 30-amp transistors. They are conservatively rated at 30 amps, and they're current shared. And that's then driven by a pair of 30-amp transistors, which is driven by one 30-amp transistor, which is then driven by a regulator. And so we're talking about three sets of VPEs there. So we're going to lose some voltage across the regulator in that. So that's where the 17 comes from, because it immediately drops it to about 14 volts. Then from 14, we have that bus that feeds the transmitters. And the transmitters are fed through programmable regulators, which are 40-amp programmable regulators actually capable of supplying 90 amps. And these regulators are controlled by the computer. And by controlling the output voltage on the final amplifiers of the transistor of the transmitters, we can control the output power. So from the touch tone pad, we can change the power levels of the repeater to be low power or high power. And the computer, by CMOS signals, can control a 90-amp regulator. Then we also have distribution buses, which are a 10-amp, 5-volt supply for the main processor bus, separate 12-volt regulators for each receiver, separate 12-volt regulators for each exciter, separate 12-volt regulators for each pre-driver. So it's a pretty isolated system. And the batteries are in there providing approximately 300 farads of filtering along with the filter capacitors that are there, and the batteries are float charged at all times. One of the software pieces that we have worked on is monitoring of the battery condition and cycling the batteries from the power supply to actually turning off the PG&E and running the system on the batteries to keep the batteries from deteriorating their ability or basically getting their losing their memory for the ability to store charge. So it's been a pretty intricate system in the power distribution, and the power supply took the better part of about 8 months to put together and really get to be reliable, and it has been very reliable under some very adverse conditions that it's been put through. Any other questions? Yes?
Do you have this interface with the teletype where you can call it up?
Yeah.
Over the telephone line through your debug program?
We have his personal telephone company data modem is attached to a telephone line, and the RS-232 line is connected to that, so we can call it up on the phone.
Call it up on the phone. People don't even know I'm there.
Right.
And sit there and hack.
One of the interesting things is to look at, we did a look when the processor was still down in the lab to see how much time it was really spending doing things. And when the processor was doing its most sophisticated tasks, it was spending 95% of its time idle. It was only using 5% of its time to do the work, and 95% of the time it was just sitting there, sleeping. Yes?
Also, why did you, after you said at the beginning you were able to get an 8080 relatively easy, why did you change your mind and spend $300 for 6800?
Because the architecture on a 6800 is a lot better.
You can't get an 8080 to do what this does in one board. It just doesn't work. That's a runnable system with a clock board. I can write a program with this board and this board. This is the clock and this is the CPU. And I can have it typing messages back at me.
And have it making BNPF ROM tapes.
And I can make a ROM tape from that. And I don't think you can do that with that much integrated circuit on an 8080. Besides, it takes more power.
Plus, the problem with the 8080 is because of its instruction set and its architecture. We figured that it would probably take about 50% more code to do the same thing that we're doing.
Yeah.
Easier to code a 6800.
Much.
Much easier, and the 6800 is more of a computer architecture. Yeah. Than a
6800 was designed by a guy who knew what a computer was, and it looks like the 8080, from my recollection, was an overgrown 8008. The 8008 was designed as a special purpose device. For a controller.
A dedicated controller. And in fact, we found out that the 8080, the original 8080 design, which was the first ones that came out that were P-channel, the 8080 was originally designed as a system for data point for their little data point computing. Pardon me?
8,000.
Yeah, the 8,000.
Well, the 8080 was also designed for the data point. It never was put in, but the head of microprocessors of Intel has given me the whole history of the 8080. And the 8080, the reason why it came about to all of the consumers was because it was designed for data point and they never used it. And all of a sudden, Intel had spent an awful lot of money with that. And they got a guy who was pretty sharp with marketing, and they got some guys who were pretty sharp with software, and they put together a good system for people to use. But for our purposes, we felt that it was just, it did not have the power that we needed for what we had to do. Yes?
Is the instruction set on, the actual instruction set on the Z80 get around the
processor? No, it doesn't. In fact, the Z80, it's interesting. I was speaking to a gentleman yesterday at Technicron in Oakland who has done quite a bit of work with the 8080 in currency identifiers. They have a machine that you could put in, take a bunch of currency, American currency, British currency, Japanese currency, whatever you want, put it through the machine at 40 bills a second, and it will sort them into the various currencies and the denominations of the currencies. And they use an 8080 in that. And he said, we went to use a Z80 to do that. And he said, we sat down, and yes, it has a lot more powerful instruction set, but after it got finished executing those more powerful instructions, it was about half the speed of the 8080 doing the same thing with more code. Because it takes a lot more time to execute those instructions, even though they've sped the machine up, the indication is that it takes a lot more time. And likewise, they said that taking a look at the differential, he would have preferred the 6800 in that area. Any other questions?
Have you published any of your...
There's a thing coming out in the next...
March?
No, well, it was scheduled for March. It was scheduled first for December, then February, and March. Now it's June. The next edition of the FM Repeater Handbook will have a complete description and photographs and things of the system as we've done it and how we've done it. The company that is now building the systems is located in San Mateo, and they put together a complete manual and operators and device, and they sell the systems outboard to people who want to put together computer systems. They're not a hobby computer company. They're actually using the system in radio communications areas, but they do sell to people who want to buy a processor. We think that the way that we put it together was a good way for learning the processor and also using it. It's more of a usable system than it is a learning system like a Motorola Exerciser or the AMI S6800. The thing is designed more for that type of area. Yes?
What is it sell
for? You can put together with a 4K memory card for under $500. The clock, the CPU, and the 4K memory card for under $500. And if you want an I/O port, you can do it for under $550. So. Any other questions? Swivitech. Yeah. I got a few brochures up here if anybody wants them. Any other questions? Thank you very much.